Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast on the eve of NFL kickoff weekend, I guess we call it.
The eve of NFL kickoff weekend, but really this is like, I mean, this is the kickoff night.
Yes.
So kickoff eve would have been yesterday. Wednesday. And in fact, as we're just to let you know, we're recording this while the pregame show for Patriots Steelers is on. And of course, you can't spell Patriots without PSI.
You know, I haven't heard that one.
I just dropped that on Twitter about 20 minutes ago.
Oh, Lord.
I didn't. Yeah, I'm like, has anyone said this? Well, I haven't heard it, so I'm going to tweet it out.
Patriots are a bit of a touchy subject as a Panthers fan. That loss still rankles me, but
in particular, in light of the news this week, it rankles Jerry Richardson, who we know is one of the more influential owners in the National Football League. So I can't imagine the conversations between the Big Cat, as he's called, inside the Panthers building, and the league offices on Park Avenue. I can't imagine those conversations were very pleasant.
I mean, it's always tough looking back on that and John Casey's kickoff. But anyway, that's just something that always sticks in the back of my mind.
It's the closest that the city of Charlotte has ever come to true sporting bliss.
Yeah. However, that Steve Smith touchdown against the Rams will always be pretty close.
And that's a very nice transition.
Yes.
To Broncos Ravens week one. And the fact that Steve Smith, he is still the Ravens' most dangerous target going into this, his final NFL season.
We've touched on him in the previous episodes of the podcast, going back to last year when he spilled blood and guts, the Panthers' blood and guts, that is, over the field in their rematch, I guess. Or not rematch, but their match with him returning to Carolina to play them.
Well, no, the game was in Baltimore, the regular season game.
Was it?
That they had. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
It was at M&T Bank Stadium, and the Panthers were the lambs to the slaughter.
Yes.
That day, and there was blood and guts. But I would expect nothing less from Steve Smith, because few players in recent NFL history have put as more of themselves into his craft, into the game, as Steve Smith has. I mean, obviously, we know about the incidents where he's gone over the line.
Sure.
But you have to respect his work ethic. You have to respect the tireless effort, the persistence. And then from a physical perspective, you have to respect the ability to go up and make catches in traffic, the body control he has in midair, and he's still capable of making those plays downfield.
He is incredible. He is one of the most fun players, personalities to watch every Sunday.
If he'd had better quarterbacking for most of his career, I believe we would be talking about Steve Smith as a surefire Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah. Back a couple weeks ago, a month ago, when I went to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I was sitting there with one of our video guys, Austin, and I was talking about how Reggie White is the only Panther in the Hall of Fame. And
Kevin Green hasn't made it.
Not yet.
Yeah.
And he asked me, well, who would be in the Hall of Fame from the Panthers? And I said, well, without a Super Bowl, probably none, but Steve Smith.
I will argue for Steve Smith for the Hall of Fame. If by chance somehow I am ever in that room as a selector for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I would be willing to take up the cause of Steve Smith.
He's like a wrestling character. He's always got something to say.
Mm-hmm.
He's never afraid to say it.
And you're not sure if he's a bad guy or a good guy. It depends on your perspective.
Fun.
Is he a hero or a villain? He's been both.
Yes.
In his career.
He's a great heel, too.
He is a great heel. I lean, but my respect for him and dealing with him when I covered the Panthers for a couple of years, I lean more toward the hero side myself, especially considering just the awful situation growing up that he worked his way out of. And the fact that it's funny because he has the reputation of, you know, being a hothead on the field. He's a complete homebody away from football.
I didn't know that.
It's all about his wife and kids.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Coaching his kids' soccer teams. I mean, he's
you know, speaking he's of about soccer his, teams.
It, yeah, in a boring I don't mean this in a bad way. He's as boring as it gets away from football, and that's okay.
You know, I guess this is why he had such a good relationship with Moose Muhammad. But Moose Muhammad, I saw him at a youth soccer game. His son was playing, and we had a cross-country practice at, like, in the same park. And he was just sitting there in the bleachers. So another Panthers wide receiver turned soccer dad.
Yep.
So
Muhsin Muhammad, and for a brief time before Steve Smith got there, Muhsin Muhammad's partner in crime was Patrick Jeffers, a former Bronco who was traded to the Panthers and had one really big season in 1999 with Steve Berline, another guy who would be a Bronco at quarterback, and then he shredded his knee the following preseason. I believe he actually tore his ACL when he slipped on a spot, I think it was in Pittsburgh, on a Three River Stadium turf. Oof. Where somebody had thrown up.
Oh, gross.
And may have been slick, and it like lost his footing, and that was
insult
that was
to injury.
Yes, the insult caused the injury.
Yeah,
in a manner of speaking.
Well, the connections are endless, and we have plenty of those this week as well with Gary Kubiak, Rick Dennison, Brian Perriani, even Tony Coaxum, all on the coaching side.
Mm-hmm.
Darian Stewart, safety. Who was on the Ravens?
Don't forget
year.
Owen Daniels.
Owen Daniels. You know, I was talking to Owen in the locker room, and this is coming on the heels of the conference call to the Joe Flacco and John Harbaugh. And someone had asked Joe Flacco if he thinks he's elite, which is a question I'm sure he gets every week, every day. It hounds him. It is an internet meme at this point.
Well, he brought a little bit of upon himself because back in 2012, it came up when he suggested it in October of that year.
Oh,
and
well,
that's
now
when
he's
it
paying the price.
Wouldn't start going. It's lingered. Let's face it. He probably didn't do himself any favors by struggling the year after winning the Super Bowl, but he was very good last year. Whether maybe you call him elite, I don't know. That's whatever word you want to use. And I think he has the potential to be even better this year. You look at how Gary Kubiak got a career best season out of him, and now he's working with Mark Trestman. And obviously, the Bears did not do well as a team with Trestman as a head coach. But you look at what Josh McCown did.
Some guys are better as coordinators and
yeah, he's
head coaches.
And he was a good CFL head coach. I think Chicago, there was some dysfunction there that went beyond him. I also think that offense, and it was sort of proven in 2013, that offense can work with a lot of different quarterbacks because Josh McCown tore it up. But Jay Cutler, you know, was very good in 2013. And Cutler had, by some measurements, the best year of his career in 2014, even as the Bears struggled. So chances are, Trestman's going to get something exceptional out of Joe Flacco. If you want to call it elite, fine. I don't know. That's up to you, dear listener. But
I asked I asked Owen Daniels, how often does Flacco get it? And he just kind of like rolled his eyes and was like, I don't know, but it's beyond the pale.
Yeah, he can't live it down.
It was, I mean, we obviously know PFT Commenter from Twitter, who's very popular. And,
yes.
And PFT Commenter made a little trip to Cleveland to go, I guess, pay a visit to the Republican presidential debate, I guess I'd call it, yeah?
Yes.
And he was spotted in the background of an MSNBC studio shot. or set shot on the scene from Cleveland with a sign that says, "Is Joe Flacco a elite QB?"
Those exact words. No.
Yes. So, yeah, that joke's come and stayed, and
it's
frankly,
not going away.
PFT Commenter is the only one who can really pull it off with his persona, but that's not going to stop people from asking him about it. Let's move on a little bit. Unless you have something to add with that, or
well, no, I don't want to get into a political. I don't want to turn this into a go down the political rabbit hole. I think I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Let's keep going. This first game is going to be a huge test. There's no two buts about it. The Ravens are a consistent playoff team, as we've talked about many times before. When it comes to that defense, they're always physical. They're always fast. They're always just monsters on the field. Terrence Suggs is just Terrell Suggs, I should say, is. I mean, he's got to be with Ray Lewis since his retirement. He is the leader of that defense.
Well, I think you got to throw Elvis Neuerville in as well for the former Bronco. And you know, we talk about Steve Smith and what he did going against his old team. Now, this isn't the first time that Elvis Neuerville has faced the Broncos since everything went down with the facts and letting him go in March of 2013. But he's coming off a year in which he matched his career high in sacks. And he is clearly elite, what he does. And you know he's coming in wanting a little blood and guts of his own. And that brings us to, frankly, what I think is going to be one of the most fascinating matchups of the game. And it is Terrell Suggs and Elvis Neuerville, whoever's lining up opposite Tyson Briley, I hate to use the cliche thrown to the wolves, but my goodness, the young left tackle, we are going to find out what he has right away, because in the span of just over 100 hours, he's going to have snaps against Neuerville, Suggs, Justin Houston, and probably Tom Bahaly as well in Kansas City. You know, that's if you're looking for one spot to watch these in this compressed week, these two games to open the season in 5 days. I think that's what you're going to look at, considering the quality of pass rusher he's going to have to face.
Just doing some quick math, that's like 60 sacks from 2014 between those four players. It was 29 between between the Ravens.
And Justin Houston was at, was it 20?
I think it was 20.
20?
I think it was an even 20.
Yeah, and yeah, 60, that's incredible.
That is daunting.
He's faced a lot of tough pass rushers throughout the preseason and throughout training camp. The daily work against Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, that's pretty much second to none that for a young offensive lineman to receive. And then, frankly, no rest from Shane Ray or Shaq Barrett either when they came in, because they've shown that they can be solid pass rushers in this league. But certainly, you know,
he's also gotten some help with Evan Mathis has talked about.
Yes.
First of all, Tyson Briley gets a lot of help with Evan Mathis lining up beside him. He said he's bounced a lot of questions off of him, and that experience as a decade veteran will come in handy for some Briley to kind of be able to pick his brain. But where was I going? Mathis was saying that Sambrilo and Paradis as well really carry themselves like veterans.
Yeah, in fact, Mathis was on the ESPN Denver radio today, and his quote was, "If I came here and you didn't tell me that Tyson Briley was a rookie, I wouldn't think he was a rookie."
Wow.
The game is not overwhelming to him at all. He plays hard. He's smart. He's tough. I definitely
those are
good
strong words.
Yes.
Yeah.
Strong words from a strong man. And the thing I know about Evan Mathis is he wouldn't say them just to blow smoke up people's butts.
Right.
That is sincere. He speaks his mind. He speaks what he believes. And that kind of praise, I think, helps explain why the Broncos were willing to put Sambrilo out there at left tackle the day after Ryan Clay tore his ACL to start finding out what they had. And, you know, obviously they were, you know, as we saw with Evan Mathis, they were willing to make moves later on in camp to upgrade the line, but here we are at week one, and Tyson Brailo is the starting left tackle. And we'll see what he has going forward. But I think there's going to be some bumps, no doubt. But I think he's got the mental mindset to handle the job. Now it'll just be actually going out and doing it.
Yeah, that confidence. We haven't really talked about that, about the decision to move him from to left tackle, because when they had Chris Clark, that's a guy who really kind of had a much better time at left tackle, I thought,
right,
than right tackle.
And actually, it was when I asked Kubiak about what the plan was to, you know, when Clady went down, and I said, might it be Chris Clark or might it be something else? And that's when Kubiak said, we're going to give Ty the first look.
Yeah. They have a better amount of data to work from than I can. Go back and look at all of his snaps from CSU. So they obviously know more than I do about
and they're gambling on potential. With Chris Clark, you knew what he was. He's probably not going to get any better at this point. I mean, he first broke into the league in 2008. You have an idea what he is at this point. But with Tyson Brailo, you don't know, and you're saying, okay, you're thinking, okay, we like his upside, we like his potential. Can he rise to the occasion? We believe in our ability to coach a guy up. And now that you have Mathis next to him, you believe in the ability of a savvy, tough veteran presence next to him to help get the best out of him. You look at the offensive line. When OTA started, there were twin pillars, left tackle Ryan Clady, right guard Luis Vasquez, both recent pro bowlers, recent all pros. And, yeah, it was tough losing Ryan Clady, no doubt. But now here we are at the start of the season, and you have the twin pillars again. Mm-hmm. Because Evan Mathis, like Luis Vasquez, was an All-Pro in 2013. Mathis was a Pro Bowler again in 2014. Might have been All-Pro again if he had not missed the first seven games to a knee injury. There's a lot, despite the youth on the Broncos line, with two starters who've never taken a regular season snap in Cimbrello, and of course Matt Paradis at center. Despite the youth, I think there's a lot of teams that would look at the Broncos offensive line with two recent All-Pros and say, I would trade my line for theirs in a heartbeat.
And with that in mind, let's segue into the running game as we prepare to face a daunting front. You know, they made a trade in the offseason, and Olodinata is now in Detroit. But you know what you're going to get from this front, which, as Ronnie Hillman said on Thursday, is that you don't know what you're going to get. A lot of different looks that they'll see.
And they will probably use those edge rushers to set up some pressure up the middle, as in, you know, if you can attack from the flanks, and maybe you're forcing the running back and the fullback, whoever they are in a given play, to monitor Suggs and Dumervil on the outside, then you're creating creating an opportunity for your inside linebackers to blast up the A and B gaps and make plays happen. And if you look back at the preseason, particularly that game against San Francisco, we know what Navarro Bowman did to wreak havoc on the Broncos' pass protection scheme. We know what he did just shooting up the A gap. You know, C.J. Anderson is one of the best blocking running backs in the league. After he became the starter in Week 10, from that point forward, among all running backs in the league, according to Pro Football Focus's metrics, ranked sixth in pass blocking. You know he can do it. And
Evan Mathis should help.
Mathis should help, but at the same time, Navarro Bowman came through the A gap so fast, and CJ got there but couldn't quite hold him up, and Manning had to take the sack.
Yeah.
So even though Anderson's very good at that, even though Ronnie Hillman has improved at that area of his game, I think you're going to see the Ravens use their inside linebackers and even their safeties from time to time and try to attack on the blitz and see if they can't generate some pressure. It discombobulates the Broncos' offense a bit.
Now, flipping that over, with the Broncos' defense going against the Ravens' offense, we've talked about Steve Smith. Their second, kind of third wide receivers are still kind of up in the air. Breshad Perriman hasn't practiced since July. It looks like it'll be Kamar Aiken or Marlon Brown. So, I mean,
there was a movie a long time ago where there was a character named Marlon Brown.
What movie?
A movie called How I Got Into College.
Oh.
a pretty forgettable late 80s
beef flick.
Waste of 95 minutes about a kid applying to college and the process he goes through.
Oh.
And
that's a movie format that hasn't
that pond hasn't been fished out. But yeah, I remember the character's name was Marlon Brown. Phil Hartman was in it. He was like one of the SAT coaches.
What?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Phil Hartman and I think Phil Hartman and Nora Dunn were like they were coaching students on how to take the SAT.
My goodness.
And one of the students was named Marlon Brown. Well, anyway,
a different Marlon Brown who has experience starting. I think they said they might go with Kumar Aiken. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember what they said. Either way, they both have some experience. They have a Pro Bowler and Justin Forsett in the backfield. They use a lot of the same principles that obviously Gary Kubiak implemented last year.
Yeah, they'll maintain some of them, but at the same time, like Brandon Marshall mentioned, you're also looking at Chicago Bears,
right?
Game tape.
Yeah.
When you're studying the Ravens offense, because there are going to be concepts that Mark Trestman's brought over, and you can see some of them in the preseason. And it's a very explosive offense. It's a very precise offense. Obviously, I would say that the depth at receiver and the quality of the top two receivers doesn't match what the Bears had when they had Brandon Marshall, the receiver,
right,
and Alshon Jeffrey. I mean, certainly Steve Smith can match up with any of them, but until Breshad Perriman gets going, I think they may kind of struggle a little bit to replicate that production. But at the same time, you know, Justin Forsett's very dangerous coming out of the backfield. He's going to make some plays. They're going to move the ball at times on Sunday, I think, even against this very stout defense.
Their offensive line hasn't been really talked about a whole lot, I've kind of noticed. But, I mean, those guys really paved the way last year for Forsett to kind of break out after he'd been kind of wandering around the league. Gary Kubiak mentioned that they kind of lost some of those longtime starters towards the end of the year previously, but they'll be back, a lot of longtime starters up on the front. And without Derek Wolf, the Broncos will also be likely without Kenny Anunoki, I would guess, after he didn't practice on Thursday.
Yeah, still watching in a bucket
Short
hat.
Rotation, it seems like they'll have. But Vance Walker, Antonio Smith will be expected to kind of step up in there. Obviously, two guys who are experienced veterans. I think that helps them a lot as opposed to having maybe a younger guy.
And there will be some different looks. I mean, don't be surprised if part of the solution is maybe even having some sub packages, two lineman sets where one of the guys that has his hand in the dirt is DeMarcus Ware.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of permutations you can have from this. What I think is going to be most interesting to watch in this game is you're gonna have a very good debate over which of these is the best guard tandem in the league. Vasquez and Mathis, or Marshall Yanda and Kelechi Osemele. Both of the, I think, a lot of people will say that the Ravens have the best guard play in the league. I think the Broncos can, once they get going with Vasquez and Mathis working in this scheme. But where that comes into play is you have Danny Trevathan and Brandon Marshall playing their first games in the pros as inside linebackers.
Mm-hmm.
And in this alignment, they're going to have to take on those guards quite a bit as they get to the second level. But the way it's designed, and you know the way the nose tackle works, so they've often got to fight off that traffic before they can make the tackle. And these two are outstanding at getting out in front and making sure those inside linebackers can't make plays. So that's a matchup that bears monitoring. Now going back and rewatching some of Trevathan's Kentucky tape. He's fought off some guards before, but he's going to have to deal with two elite ones. You know, just as you see with Tyson Brailo on offense, we're going to find out a lot right away about Marshall and Trevathan as inside linebackers, because this might be the toughest challenge they face all year.
And with the difference in the defense moving from a two-gap scheme to more of a one-gap, whereas you had a guy like Terrence Knighton taking up one or two up in the middle on double teams, the focus for Sylvester Williams, Malik Jackson are going to be getting through the line. So I think it'll be a little bit more pressure on them to make plays in the backfield or stopping folks at the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. The other player that will be missed, it will be TJ Ward. You made him one of your, the impact player or the, is it the BMW film review?
Yes, during the, during the Houston game. Is that, or after the Houston game, I should say, mm-hmm. because of how they were using him. And now, I mean,
Swiss Army knife.
Almost, yeah. The way they you know, linebacker, traditional safety, sometimes single high safety, lining up in the slot. You really didn't know where TJ Ward was going to be on a given play. So, it's going to be interesting to see how he's replaced. I think we'll see a lot of David Bruton, but
we'll see probably a lot of dime,
a lot of dime packages. I think we'll see, you know, see Omar Bolden out there a bit. Mm-hmm. I think Kayvon Webster. As an extra corner, if they go four corners, two safeties, David, and maybe something to watch is where they line up Bradley Roby. We go back to earlier in the offseason when they were talking about him being a safety in some looks. Would not surprise me if that notion reemerges on Sunday.
Yeah, I tried to ask. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but with Bruton's special teams work. And Darian Stewart's on kickoffs, especially in the preseason. I asked Stewart on Thursday about if that affects anything as a defensive player playing on special teams in addition to being a starter. And he sees it more as paying your dues, you know, doing mm-hmm. whatever you can to make an impact on the roster and all the phases. So he didn't seem to think of it as anything more than that, really. And with Bruton playing pretty much all the special team snap, that might bear some monitoring, but it does.
Yeah.
I think if you asked him, and I did not think of that in time to ask him a day ago, but I think if you asked him, he would kind of shrug it off too.
Yeah.
So the kickoff for this Thursday night game, we're watching it as it happens. Mace, as we wrap up this podcast, I noticed that one of the guys had a Microsoft Surface with a strap, a hand strap,
mm-hmm.
and you can kind of just hold it.
Interesting.
You think that's going to be a – see if we can talk to someone in IT about that?
Well, I've got a Surface. Maybe they can hook it up just with a strap. And
that would help during press conferences.
Yeah, it would. I mean, but I think but you're using the tablet. You're not using the keyboard, so you've got to learn how to tap pretty fast. But, yeah, that might have some applications. Like, I was noticed this week, I'll sometimes stand off to one side at the press conference, and I'll put my foot on the little podium where the mm-hmm. subject stands so I can at least kind of make a desk for myself, and I pull out my iPad, and I've got a keyboard hooked up to it now. I'll be typing into the keyboard that I have hooked up to the iPad with one hand, and the other hand I'll be holding the recorder.
You are.
I've got to find a way to
man.
Make this thing more efficient.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to do it, to be honest. It's tough enough for me to try and take notes during like a press conference, like standing up.
Well,
it's fine sitting down and taking notes.
If I were standing off to the side, I would have no problem
right.
getting. Just tweeting away, but when I'm up there trying to record it as well, it gets a little hairy. But that's, you know, I'm trying to multitask as well as I can. Kickoff weekend. I feel like we've just waited so long.
Yeah.
For this moment, what's your prediction on the record, or are you not going to give one?
For which?
Broncos record this year.
Oh, Broncos record on the record. You know, that's tough. You know, we all have our biases. I'll go 11-5. I think they still come out with the division win. I think it'll be tougher. The competition's a little bit increased this year, mm-hmm. but I still think they have one of the most talented rosters in the league.
They do.
They have, I think, what might be the best defense in the league. We'll have to wait and find out.
Maybe not in the traditional metrics like yards per game, but I think it's going to be among the leaders, if not the leader, in sack rate, takeaway rate, points per possession,
And you can't really, this is so like anti-statistical of me, but in things you can't measure, like how intimidating a defense is, I think they'll be.
Yes.
They'll be a league leader in intimidations per game.
Yeah. Oh my God. How are we going to stop these guys from getting into the backfield? I agree with you on 11-5. And I'm going to go a step further and say, I think this team wins at least one playoff game at home and at least one playoff game in the road. I'm convinced that this team is going to play above its playoff seeding. Like 11-5, it wouldn't surprise me if they're the number three seed in the postseason and have to play that first round. But then it wouldn't surprise me if they win at home in the first round and then go on the road in the divisional round and knock off one of the top two teams in the AFC. I could easily see that happening.
I've got to add that my prediction is not based on anything besides gut feeling. I have not looked at, like, poured over the schedule and seen, like, assigned wins and losses to each one. It's just a general feeling of how successful they will be.
It's interesting because as I did the wins and losses for the whole league, I actually came up with the Houston Texans as a playoff team. They have a very weak schedule and they put another defense like the Broncos that could scare people. Especially if Jadeveon Clowney gets going. Clowney,
God, I hope he does.
Cushing, J.J. Watt. That becomes a front seven where you've got to pick your poison if Clowney can bring anything.
Right.
And Houston was kind of my mild surprise that I had getting into the playoffs in the AFC. In the NFC, the team I have... I have two teams bursting forward and surprising and getting in the postseason. They may be perceived as surprises. One is Minnesota. Like them. Like their trajectory. Love Teddy Bridgewater, and I think that he can really get. I think he could have his breakout year this year. He was playing at, and to go back to elite, he was playing at an elite level the last five, six games of last year. Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to carry that over into this season. And out of the NFC South, I do have an affinity for the Panthers. Many of y'all may know that I did work for the Panthers back in the late 2000s. But I have Atlanta taking the NFC South.
I don't see the Panthers winning the division after they lost probably the most key player besides Cam Newton on their offense.
Yeah. I think the most key player would be Keekly.
Why
besides
on
Cam.
Offense.
Oh, on offense. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, that's true.
Greg Olsen's great.
I think the thing with the NFC South and why I have the Falcons emerging, that is the most talented roster, even though they've struggled. All you're asking of that defense is be close to average.
Well, if the team's close to average in their record, that might be enough to take that division.
New Orleans is going in the wrong direction. I think Carolina has a similar season to last year. And Tampa Bay, I think Jameis Winston, the learning curve is going to be too steep. And that actually, looking league-wide, to me, the most fascinating matchup of week one, it's not this Thursday night game. It's not Broncos-Ravens, even though that's going to be intriguing. It's nothing on Sunday night or Monday night. It's Bucks-Titans in Tampa, Jameis Winston versus Marcus Mariota. Why this game is not the Monday Night Football lead, the first part of the doubleheader. Why this game wasn't put in that slot, I have no idea. Okay, yeah, they were both a combined 4-28 last year. But everyone who follows football, I think, on some level, wants to see Mariota and Winston and how they do in their first games.
Your two quarterbacks that are going to be the future of the league, then you would kind of want that in prime time.
Yes, I would think so. But what do I know?
A lot.
Instead, we've got Eagles-Falcons. And Eagles-Falcons, I'm not going to denigrate Eagles-Falcons completely. That's going to be an interesting matchup to start the Monday night doubleheader. And by the way, there should be a Monday night doubleheader every week.
Yeah.
There should be a Monday night doubleheader every week. And when we get to the point where there are eight games in London, whether it's a team that's based in London or just simply having eight neutral site games, then we should have the package of games always at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time from London. If there was a way to have 16 games at that time slot over the course of the year, I'd say do it.
Man, D'Angelo Williams looks pretty good. He's been playing well so far.
This is his 10th season.
That's crazy to me.
Isn't it? I will always have an affection for D'Angelo Williams. I was there for his apex in 2008.
The nickname for the Jay Stew and him, the duo, the running back duo?
Double Trouble.
Was it Double Trouble?
I think that's what we settled on, Double Trouble. Because Thunder and Lightning got to remember
that
you had
Chris Johnson
and Lendale White in Tennessee. It's interesting to look back on the 2008 season. The best teams in the regular season that year, you had the Steelers, who are off in there, but Tennessee had the top seed in the AFC. The Giants and Panthers tied for the best record in the NFC. That year, looking back, appears to be such an anomaly. I mean, that's where Arizona went to the Super Bowl.
I won't. That NFC Championship game was embarrassing.
You mean the divisional playoff?
Or divisional
playoff. Jake Dome meltdown? And
that was just like all his like decline just came rapidly, just like he had been in kind of a decline, and they're like, their offense had just struggled for so long, but then all of a sudden it's just like,
you know, I don't want to put too much on John Fox, but boy oh boy, when his teams lose in the postseason, with the exception of Super Bowl 38, my goodness, it's awful. And I look back at that game for the Panthers. I believe it was Mark Jones. He returned the opening kickoff to about the 50. And Panthers just run the ball right down the Cardinals' throats on the opening series. Get a touchdown on the first drive. Bank of America Stadium is just in raptures. And then the next possession, the Panthers get the ball back and go three and out after three runs, and they punt. And for some reason, they just abandoned the run, which I will never understand. That was the bread. I mean, that was the bread and butter of that team, and they used to wear people out. I mean, the thing I liked about that Panther team covering it that year was it was so patient. Okay, yeah, they'd have some three and outs while they got the running game going, and that's something to kind of remember this year. You have to be patient with the running game. You have to know that if you keep pounding. Okay, you know what? There's going to be a couple. There's going to be some drives that go nowhere early as you're probing the defense. But then, as the game goes on, you're going to wear out the opponent. And that's what those Panthers did in 2008 with D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart. And boy, for the Broncos, wouldn't it be great to see C.J. Anderson and Ronnie Hillman emerge as that kind of duo? And have that sort of production, which has happened in the Kubiak offense. If you look back at Arian Foster and Ben Tate in 2011, it can be done, but you've got to be patient. And on that night in Charlotte, the Panthers got impatient, lost their nerve, and Jake Delhomme melted down. And then, of course, the infamous quote from Fox after the game: "We picked a bad day to have a bad day."
I think that's the ultimate Fox quote.
And after the Super Bowl 48 loss. Obviously, when you're close to a team and covering a team that gets shredded like that, there's a lot on your mind. It's not a happy occasion at all. But one of the things that went through my mind, I walked up to a Darren Gant, who covered the Panthers at the time and now writes for Pro Football Talk, and I said, for Foxy's sake, I just hope he doesn't say we picked a bad day to have a bad day. I really hope he didn't.
Looking back on that rushing tandem, though, the one game I go back to, the Monday night game.
Against Tampa Bay.
I had a friend.
The beginning of the end of the John Gruden, Monty Kiffin era.
Mm-hmm.
And
God, they were.
It had just leaked
destroyed.
That Kiffin was going to follow his son. At that point, the word was getting out that mm-hmm. Monty Kiffin was going to leave to go join, because Lane Kiffin was taking the Tennessee job.
Right.
That he was going to go join him in Knoxville. And the Bucs defense that month melted down. The Bucs as a whole melted down. They went from 9-3 to 9-7, but they were 9-3 going into that game. It was a Monday night football battle for first place in the NFC South. Both teams, they were tied for the best record in the conference. It's about as good a money. It was about as good a
terrific game.
It's about as good a Monday night matchup late season as you could have possibly hoped for. Because of course you don't have flexible scheduling.
Well,
and so it's a crapshoot.
Williams and Stewart had 301 yard rushing,
and it was shocking against that Bucs defense. Now looking at what the Bucs defense was by the end of the year, it wasn't, because this was the beginning of the end. But that was still a good defense going into that game, and you would never have expected the Buccaneers at that point to give up 300 plus rushing yards,
four touchdowns on the ground.
Yeah, it was. I've watched a lot of Buccaneer football over the years because I spent quite a few years in Tampa. That game was mind-blowing, sitting in the press box watching it and seeing, you know, a defense led by Derek Brooks just get absolutely eviscerated by Stewart and Williams.
I had a friend who was a huge Bucs fan, and obviously that game was what the entire week like was leading up to, and everyone was getting heated. And then after the game, he just kind of shut down. I mean, that was just a stupendous game. Five sacks for the Panthers against Jeff Garcia. Yeah.
But to look back at running games like that, and that's what you hope the 2015 Denver Broncos can do on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That they can impose their will with the ground game in a way that hasn't happened around here. Well, it kind of happened in 2011, but when the Broncos had the number one rushing attack, but
right.
A good chunk of that was Tebow. And let's face it, that offense is a gimmick that the Broncos exploited for as long as possible until some smart defensive coordinators by the end of, that they faced at the end of this season, not just coordinators, but defensive minds. I'm thinking of guys like Bill Belichick, Dave Wannstedt was working in Buffalo. They had the Bills had a great game plan. Romeo Crennel was coaching the Chiefs. He had a great game plan in week 17 that neutralized that offense. So it's the last time the Broncos had a running game that really just drove it down your throat and imposed its will. I'm going to say this. It was Gary Kubiak's last year as offensive coordinator before he went to Houston, 2005. Mike Anderson and Tatum Bell were the running backs. Whoa. They split the work. And that was very much a thunder and lightning type combo.
We'll just have to wait until Sunday to see what the Broncos rushing game can bring. I can't wait.
I'm pumped. I'm jacked. Let's get this thing started. We've waited too long for this. By the time the Broncos take the field on Sunday, it will have been
eight months
and 2 days since the Colts loss. If I'm excited, if I've got a lot of pent-up energy and I'm just some goof in the press box, I know the players have it, and I know the coaches have it too.
Mace is gonna get this going to do laps before the pregame show.
Maybe I should get a lot of that energy out of my system. I'm ready for this.
Woo!
Let's do it.
All right, and with that, we'll leave you with the podcast. Everyone, enjoy the game. We will catch you in preparation for week 2.